This is your community radio station, 88.3 Southern FM.
And coming up right now is the Space Show. Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie, and I'm flying solo tonight. Okay, on this week's The Space Show, we remember the astronaut who found and then lost the moon. How is that possible? Well, stick around and we'll tell you. Of course, we're talking about James Lovell. Let's head off with a song to introduce things. It's called Song of the Astronauts. It was written by May Boren-Axton and Tommy Durden, and was recorded in 1962 by Tommy Durden. And by the way, these two people wrote a song called Heartbreak Hotel for a guy called Elvis Presley. Well, this song is about the seven Project Mercury astronauts.
We ride the thunder that tears the sky asunder. We ride the thunder to the stars. With rocket engines blasting to fame everlasting, we ride the thunder to the stars. We're seven pioneers headed for the new frontier. We'll blaze a trail from here to Mars. For we ride the thunder that tears the sky asunder. We ride the thunder to the stars. Every time we blast off, earthly ties we cast off, we ride the thunderbird of space. No one knows the danger, for out there man's a stranger, and in the hands of God we place our fate. Yes, we ride the thunder that tears the sky asunder. We ride the thunder to the stars. With rocket engines blasting to fame everlasting, we ride the thunder to the stars. Ride the bird where no voice was ever heard. We ride the thunder to the stars. Ambassadors to space for the whole human race. Yes, we ride the thunder to the stars. We ride the thunder that tears the sky asunder. We ride the thunder to the stars. With rocket engines blasting to fame everlasting, we ride the thunder to the stars. We ride.
Ask a young person today who the first astronaut was, and many, if not most, would quickly say, oh, Neil Armstrong. Well, they obviously were not taught the history of human spaceflight. Most of those who lived through that period know it was Yuri Gagarin from the Soviet Union. Some would even remember the names of the early American astronauts, particularly the seven men of Project Mercury. There are a few of those early astronauts left alive, and last weekend we lost another. Jim Lovell, a veteran of four pioneering spaceflights, has died aged 97. Most of the reports of Jim Lovell's passing have limited themselves to mentioning his role in the Apollo 13 mission in 1970. However, the Jim Lovell story begins long before the near-fatal Apollo 13 failed lunar landing mission. It begins in the years immediately after World War II. Over two space shows, we will let Jim Lovell tell his own story, as told to retired television news anchor Ron Stone in Houston on 1999, May the 25th.
May 25th, 1999, Ruth Johnson Space Center. When you were a little bitty kid, you saw a rocket go off and you said, I want to do that. Is that it? Is it that simple or that complex?
Well, you know, Ron, I was interested in rockets and in astronomy long before the Glenns and the Shepherds of the world could spell rocket. I was interested way back in high school. I went to try to build some rockets. Wanted to become a rocket engineer, as a matter of fact. Wrote to the American Rocket Society at that time, which is now the AAIA, something like that. And I said, I want to become a rocket engineer. And they wrote back a very nice letter, but essentially they said, well, you ought to go to either MIT or to Caltech. I couldn't afford either. And so I took a secondary goal. I got a ROTC appointment to Wisconsin. And then from there, I went to the Naval Academy. And from there, I got into flight training, which was the second thing I wanted to do. I became a naval aviator. And lo and behold, in 1958, NASA was formed, and they were looking for astronauts. And so I was one of the original, I guess, 110 people who was selected to go for interviews.
Let me go back to your Naval Academy days. You almost didn't go to the Naval Academy. Am I right about that?
That's right. I had 2 years in Wisconsin, and I was in a naval aviation program. This is right after World War II. And I got down to pre-flight, started through pre-flight. My mother, while I was at University of Wisconsin, said, would you apply for the Naval Academy? So just to pacify her, I said, sure, I'll do that. Never expecting. In fact, I became first alternate, which normally doesn't make it anyway. And when I was down there pre-flight, I got orders from the Bureau of Personnel, report to the Naval Academy for the physical to be inducted into the Academy, if you so desired. And then I had a big question mark. Should I go to the Academy? The young Marines just back from the war said, don't do that. You're already got 2 years of college. You're already in naval aviation. If you go back, you're going to have to start all over again. You might not get back into aviation. But there was an old captain there by the name of Captain Jeter. And he said, look, son, you want to make the Navy your career? You want to get your education right now? Get yourself up to the Academy. And so that's what happened.
From the Academy, how'd you get back into airplanes?
Well, I spent, my course, 4 years at the Academy. My term paper, my first class term paper, I wrote on the development of the liquid fuel rocket, which, by the way, I just donated just last year to the Academy. And I was one of the first 50, because I was so much interested in going back into aviation, that they selected 50 people to teach at the Academy after I graduated, teach the plebes coming in. And then that September, I was transferred down to Pensacola.
And what kind of planes did you fly?
Well, in those days, we flew SNJs, which was the basic trainer, all the way up through landing on a carrier with SNJs. And we did formation and some night flying and, basic training. And then I was transferred from there to Kingsville, actually Corpus Christi, then Kingsville, and did my instrument training. And my advanced training was in a modern airplane called the Hellcat, the F-6F. And then I got my wings, and then I was selected to go back into jet training. And in those days, jet training was, the epitome of everything, and not too many people were in it. So I was very, very lucky.
Did you enjoy flying jets?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, jets were, I still enjoy flying jets if I get my hand on one. But after I got through training, my first assignment was to a squadron called VC-3. And when I got out there, I found out it was a night fighter squadron. They sent teams out because in those days we didn't fly whole squadrons off of aircraft carriers. And I told the skipper, I said, I'm having a little trouble flying in the daytime yet. You want me to go out at night? But it was great training, a great experience, and I learned an awful lot.
Anything quite compared to that first landing, night landing on a carrier?
There is nothing. Night flying off carriers separates the men from the boys. The takeoff, of course, into a black void with no horizon, and then coming in at night. And in those days, we didn't have modern techniques like a mirror system and, almost like a GCA. You had to come in low, and you had a guy with paddles and a lighted suit. That was how we did it in those days.
So at what point did you hear about NASA trying to select people to become astronauts and decide, hey, I want to do that?
Well, when I got back off a cruise, I spent some time training people. But then some of my contemporaries, my older, the pilots that were in my squadron, had already gone through a thing called test pilot school. And I thought that would be a kind of interesting thing to do. So I applied for test pilot school, and I went. And just as I graduated from the school, which was 6 months long at that time, of course, NASA was formed. And then they were talking about putting a man in space. And they had put out, at this time, secret orders to all the people who both the Air Force and the Navy thought were qualified. And NASA had certain criteria that they went by. And it just so happened that I had just finished the school, and that was one of the criteria that you had to have. And I went up for that original Mercury selection.
How far did you last in that?
Well, it got down to the last, I guess, 32 people. And I was one of the people through all the interviews, sent out to, went out to Albuquerque to the big, what was the name of it? It was a big hospital out there. And Loveless Clinic, that was it. And we went through our physicals. Now, today I just finished a physical, but that physical was nothing like anybody had ever heard of before. You know, it was what they did to us was unknown to the medical profession, because they knew that they had guinea pigs. Not only should we be in good shape, but they knew we were going to go into an environment that was completely strange. So they did things just for background and, you know, from data. And I went through there. But when I got there, the next selection was to go on to down to a second group at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for some more tests and things like that. The doctor called me in and said, well, you're finished. And I said, finished? Why? Am I not accepted? No. No. I said, what's wrong? And they said, well, you have a high bilirubin. I said, I don't even know what a high bilirubin is. What is it? Well, too much pink pigment in your blood. And so I went home, was very, very much dejected. And so I missed out on the second selection.
So this liver problem, even though it was a relatively minor thing, said no way.
As a matter of fact, on Gemini 12, Buzz Aldrin had the same thing that I had, and we were fortunate. But you know, there's a unique aspect to that physical. I got back to the squadron, and this is not too well known. I got back to the squadron, and I got a set of orders to go back out to Wright-Patterson. Now my skipper said, these orders are probably not correct. Maybe they don't know what the story is. I said, listen, I'm taking them. I went out to Wright-Patterson. And they sort of expected me. I got out there the night before, and the people that were all getting together at the BOQ said, oh, yes, we got seven people, and you're number seven. I said, oh, I'm great. The next morning, we all went down to breakfast to get ready to start our physical, and a fellow walked in and said, say, I'm sorry I'm late. I just came in from Edwards. My name is Gus Grissom. And he was number seven, and, of course, I wasn't supposed to be there. And pretty soon NASA hierarchy found out about it. I was packing my bags, going back to the squadron.
How disappointed were you when you didn't make that first
time? Yeah, very, very much disappointed, because you see, I was interested in rockets and things like that way back as a high school kid. And I didn't make it.
There was no indication past that original seven that they're ever going to find any more guys, was there at that time?
No,
no. There was a second chance?
No one actually knew how far NASA would go or whether man in space was a possibility or not. And so you're absolutely right. But that was something I always wanted to do.
How long did it take you from that disappointment to get back into the loop and get rid of the liver problem?
Well, I got back to the squadron, got transferred down to Oceana, and I was going through, training people at this time. I was an instructor. And in Aviation Week, there was a little article. NASA wants to select some more astronauts. And so before I knew it, the Navy called me down again and said, do you want to be in another selection? They didn't know that I was kicked out because of a physical. And I said, sure. And so I put my name in again, and I was selected again to go for the physical, this time at Brooks Air Force Base. Air Force physical, much more practical, much more, looking at what's wrong and what's right. And I had no problems passing it. And that's how I got selected to the second group.
When you first went for a selection to the original astronaut corps, nobody knew what an astronaut was. Second time you went, they were the biggest heroes in the world.
Well, that's true, yes. And I can recall very vividly the very first time we went, after we had our interviews in Washington at the old Dolly Madison House, we all gathered back in a hotel room and we were talking about it. Wally Schirra was there because, you know, Wally and I were in the same class. Al Shepard was there. And Wally was saying, you know, I don't know if I want to get in this program or not, you know, to go into some wacky program when I should be grew up the ladder in naval aviation and, yeah. You know, Navy hierarchy. And, of course, now I look back on it again. It was really something.
And that was Jim Lovell in conversation with Ron Stone in 1999. Well, you just heard that he very nearly made it into the Mercury 7, the original seven astronauts. Well, Mike Stewart of the Kingston Trio wrote the song These Seven Men in 1963.
He's gone away far to stay a little while, but he's coming back if he goes 10,000 miles. Who are these seven men whose path leads them so far and shake our minds to wonder who they are? They scout the new frontier to find the surest way, and they look to us, for they have shown the way. They're gone away for to stay a little while, but they're coming back if they go 10,000 miles. What is there left to look to that yet has not been done? What west is there if all the wests are one? Look not back o'er your shoulder, but high above your head, these seven men have shown the way. These seven men have said, we're gone away for to stay a little while, but we're coming back if we go 10,000 miles. We're gone, gone away.
Well, Mercury was a one-man spacecraft that made manned flights. During that project, President Kennedy made the commitment to land astronauts on the moon. To test the technology and skills required, a more advanced spacecraft was needed. And so the two-man Gemini was developed, named after the star constellation for observing reasons. On this week's The Space Show, we are celebrating the 97-year life of Jim Lovell. Now, we were playing the interview that was recorded in 1999 with Jim, so let's go back to that again.
How did the original seven accept the next group?
Very cool at first. I mean, you know, these were the days when I guess there was this the Life World Book contract, you know, and all that sort of stuff, and they were, you know, they were pretty high on the totem pole. They were muckety mucks. They were well known and everything like that. And the nine of us walk in there, but they warmed up after a while, and pretty soon after a lot of negotiations, we all got on the same bandwagon with regards to these personal stories type things.
But did you get one of those Corvettes to run around in and all that sort of thing?
After a while, yeah, it was not bad. We'd buy the one wholesale, I think, and then we'd drive it for 6 months, and we could trade it in and get another one and trade it in. I guess I went through about three Corvettes during my whole period of the time I was there. I remember Pete and I lived at Ellington Air Force Base. Our wives were still, Jane was in California, and my wife Marilyn was in Virginia Beach. And he and I shared a BOQ room. And I remember when he got that Corvette, he had the top in the room, and he was driving this Corvette. The car I got was just an old station wagon, because I had a family and I needed a station wagon, and that's what I got.
How did your life change when you became an astronaut?
Well, I don't think it really changed in a way. We got to be a little bit of a celebrity, but, you know, we didn't even do anything at first. And I can recall the very first time I went back to Milwaukee to my high school, and I gave a talk to the high school people, and I just went right to the school, got in, went to school, and in the back of the room after I was giving my talk, the mayor of Milwaukee was there. And he was sort of mad that I didn't stop by and pay my respects to the mayor before I went. You know, all this kind of protocol I knew nothing about at that time. And I thought, you know, heck, I haven't even been in space, and people are asking me, you know, what's going on, what's happening, and all that sort of stuff. So there was a little bit of false, being a false idol at the time.
What was happening to you during those Mercury days? What was your job?
Well, during the Mercury days, I got down into the space program about the time Wally was flying. In fact, the very first thing I did before I even moved down to Texas was to go down to Cape Canaveral and watch Wally take off. And then we got into some of the simulators that they had. They were not too good at the time. And we started doing some training. It amazes me now, because I was just talking just today to a brand new astronaut. Oh, he's been here years, never flown. And he says, well, I'm still going through ASCAN. I said, what's ASCAN? I have no idea. He says, astronaut candidate training. I said, astronaut candidate training? I said, when I went through, it was all hit and miss. We had people come in to teach us a little bit about orbital mechanics, and then we went out to the plants to learn all about the systems themselves, and that's how we got most of our training.
When did you move into the Gemini program, and what was your initial job there?
Well, we got into the Gemini program and started learning all about the spacecraft itself, but my first really assignment was as backup to Gemini 4. That was McDivitt and Ed White. Mm-hmm. And Frank Borman and I were the backup to that flight. And so we were training for that one. It's kind of interesting. I met Ed White, and I didn't know it until that Gemini, one time we were down at the Cape talking, and he was a plebe at West Point, and I was a plebe at the Naval Academy, and we traded cufflinks, and then we disappeared. And of course, it was years and years later that we're sitting down at the Cape having breakfast when he brings up the story, and I said, "That was me." You know, it's strange how our lives crossed and then disappeared for a while.
Get back. White's job on that flight was to do an EVA.
Yes,
that was a very big deal at that time.
Yes, it was. And one of our jobs, we had what we called an air-bearing trainer, and we had that little, like a squirt gun that we would use to fire our way around and try to do something on that. It was the initial attempt at EVA work. And Ed was out for a while, but it was not until later on that we really found out that we had a lot of problems with EVA.
How did you train for a spacewalk? How did you and White train for that first thing?
Well, we got in the suits. We had this air-bearing trainer, which is only two-dimensional. You're on sort of you're on a platform that, and it's, you know, held up by air, and then you can shoot this little gun. It's like two little jets, and try to maneuver yourself. But I have to tell you, quite honestly, it really wasn't any good. I mean, it was the best thing they could do at the time. And it was not until later on in Gemini 12 that we learned what to do.
So the mission takes off. What did you do once it left the ground and he's up there doing that? What was your job?
Well, I was down at the Cape watching the launch, and then I flew back and was in the control center, when he was doing all his work.
It's been a long time, reasonably long time, since you got here. You ready to fly? You ready to go yourself now?
Oh, yes. I got here in October of 62, and that went up in 64 or something like that. And
3 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then my first flight wasn't until December of 65.
So you and Frank Borman get that first flight. Tell me about how you felt when they told you were going to go.
Well, it was kind of interesting. Of course, Frank and I were about the same rank and everything like that, but he got, you know, Air Force, and he got to be commander of it, and that's fine. But it was a 2-week mission, as a medical flight, as a matter of fact. And, you know, 2 weeks with Frank Borman any place is a challenge. but this flight, we trained very hard. We had different types of suits. These were sort of get-me-down suits that we could, you didn't do EVAs in them. You couldn't get outside. You should not open the hatch. The very first takeoff was almost like it flying us for a while. We got to it pretty good, you know, pretty fast. We were able to get the idea of it. And the spacecraft is very tight, so I didn't feel too nauseous at all. It was pretty good. But the suits were very hot, sweaty, and bulky. And they didn't want us to take off our suits. These were the old days when they were very worried about leaks in spacecraft or something like that. Well, we knew the spacecraft wasn't leaking.
One of you had to keep a suit on at all times, right?
Yes, it was sort of a ridiculous regulation at that time. And so, but I started to unzip my suit, and my rear end was going out of the suit, and we're getting out farther and farther, and pretty soon the suit was over here, and pretty soon I slipped the helmet down. I'm out of my suit. I'm in my underwear. And so Frank wants to get out of his suit, so the ground, you know, for 3 days the ground argued with him, and the poor guy was hot, sweaty, and finally they let him get out of his suit. And, of course, my young son at that time said, Dad orbited the Earth in his underwear, which is essentially what we did.
You said it was a medical experimental flight. Did you feel like you were an experimental rat up there, as it were?
A guinea pig. Absolutely a guinea pig. The doctors, of course, were, you know, this was, can man live in space? And the reason for the mission was that the maximum time to go to the moon and back, and we're already planning for Apollo, was 2 weeks. And so they said, well, if we could put people up into zero gravity for 2 weeks, it'll prove out one aspect of the moon flights. So we stayed up there, and the old spacecraft had lots of problems with it. The fuel cells were dying slowly but surely. And I can remember quite vividly, you know, Frank doesn't even like to fly over water, much less spend 70% of his time over water. And he was anxious to come on down, and between Chris Kraft and myself, I argued with Frank. I said, Frank, don't worry. The Navy can find us regardless of where we come down. And Chris also talked to him. And so we stayed up the full 14 days.
It's strange, the phobias that people have. Well, we're looking at the life of Jim Lovell, astronaut. Now, the Gemini capsule has less room in it than the front seat of a Volkswagen Beetle or an early Fiat. Yet Jim Lovell and Frank Borman spent 2 weeks floating in that confined space. Now let's hear a little clip from history books of the launch of Gemini 7.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
On their way, they certainly were. Well, they broke the endurance record for human spaceflight. And let's see if I can cue that up and get it playing now.
77 Houston, do you still read us? Sorry to disturb your lunch, but we have a message here we think you'd be interested in. We're coming up on a special time here, about 5 seconds. Mark, you have just exceeded the world's manned space flight endurance record.
And after their flight, the astronauts had these comments to make.
I don't think I have any words that could really express the feelings that I have today about this particular mission, with the tremendous feeling that there is of first relief and the feeling that we really do have two men back, having been 14 days in that spacecraft and in good condition, and they really look at the present time to be in very, very good condition, even beyond what we could have hoped.
Now, here is Jim Lovell's recollection in 1999 of the Gemini 6 and Gemini 7 flights, as he's told to that reporter in Houston. And let's see if we can get that going.
There was some talk early on about landing Gemini on the ground, was there not?
Yes, there was. As a matter of fact, one of my jobs when I first got assigned was the recovery aspect. And we were looking at making a Regalo wing, which was developed by a NASA engineer. They're called paragliders now, or parawings. And come on down, this thing would inflate, and it'd be like a V-shaped thing, and then a guy inside the spacecraft could guide it down. And it was really going to be on the last one. The test results out at Edwards were not too good, and they thought it was very prudent not to even put it on there. Why do it for the last flight?
Can you give me some idea how you spend 14 days in that little cramped quarters with somebody else without going absolutely mad?
It's not easy, but you have to remember that you work so long. I was there 3 years for a space flight, so I'd go up with just about anybody. And Frank and I were, you know, just this close together. And you get to know each other quite well.
Yes.
It was something. As a matter of fact, Frank went, I think, 9 days without having to go to the bathroom.
9 days?
And he said, Jim, this is it. I said, Frank, you only have 5 more days left to go here.
But how was space food in those days? Because I want to get back to space food a little later.
Yeah.
But how was it then?
Strictly freeze-dried, and these little bite-sized sandwiches had wax over them because everybody thought that they needed wax to keep the crumbs. And the wax would coat the roof of your mouth, and it tastes awful. I think one of the best things they had on board those days were bacon bits. They would have a little square of bacon, and they would squeeze it after they, you know, cooked it and everything. They squeeze it down, and that was very tasty. And then you put water into various freeze-dried food, much like campers have these days, but you couldn't heat it. It was lukewarm water. But it kept us alive for 2 weeks.
Looking back on it now, all of that seems very primitive. But at that time, it was state-of-the-art.
That's right. And when I look back on how ultra, ultra conservative they were. For instance, John Young got in such a flap by taking a sandwich up on a 3.5-hour or 4-hour flight. Even if it had, you know, poison in it, he probably would have lasted for the whole flight. And now, of course, things are entirely different. And then, you know, now I know they were afraid of anything floating around, but now we found out that if the food is thick enough, he could eat it with a spoon.
When you came back from Gemini 7, what did NASA learn from these two experimental guinea pigs?
Well, they learned, number one, that man could live very nicely for 2 weeks, that the cardiovascular system would adapt quite readily, the heart slowed down, blood volume decreased, which is a normal case in a 2-week type mission, and we were able to navigate ourselves across the deck. We didn't have this orthostatic hypotension where, you know, where blood would drain down as soon as you stood up. I mean, the symptoms were there, but I mean, we could overcome that. So I think basically was the fact that, hey, space flight is possible longer than the 3 or 4 hours that, you know, they had been doing in the past.
Was it as exciting as you thought it was going to be?
Yeah, it was very exciting to me. I mean, it was tedious work, you know, 2 weeks. We did have a break when Schraw and Stafford came up and rendezvoused with us, and then they were up, I think, 24 hours, and they went back down again, and we stayed up there for the full time. But it was quite rewarding.
All these missions now, as we look back on them, fit like, you know, they all fit together. They all get us to the moon. But at that time, you were trying to do something that had to be done before we could get to the moon, and that is figure out whether you could dock in space. Am I right?
That's right. The first thing we had to learn about is to rendezvous in space. Can we get two spacecraft together, which will eventually lend itself into docking, and then we can, you know, take the lunar module out. And the very first one, of course, was the Gemini 6-7 flight. Gemini 6 was supposed to dock, rendezvous and dock with an Agena vehicle, but it went wrong with it on its takeoff, and so that delayed their flight. And so they moved Gemini 7 up to fly instead, and when we were up there, Gemini 6 was going to rendezvous. We couldn't dock with Gemini 7. They're going to rendezvous. And, of course, the first attempt to take off on Gemini 6 resulted in a shutdown, which, very fortunately, Wally didn't punch out. He was cool. The second time up there, though, they did. And they came up, I guess we were up there 11 or 12 days by that time. And you could see them coming up. They came up at night, and we had a blinking light on, and we could see the jets firing as they came up. We were like this, and they were coming up just like this. And finally, you know, we all rendezvoused. We stayed together. We each took turns flying around each other to see how nicely the spacecraft would control on something like that. So that was the very first big step towards the rendezvous and docking, which, of course, were very necessary for the lunar flights, too.
And the excitement of the two-manned spacecraft meeting in space for the first time in history was evident in their reports.
7 and 6, would you continue with the description of your station keeping?
Right now, 6 is about 10 feet above and to the left of 7. We're just flying nose-to-nose, approximately 15 feet apart.
Roger.
We can very clearly see the horizon scanners operating.
Roger, Jim. Gemini 7, are you able to see in the windows of 6 very easily and vice versa?
Roger, 7 here.
And we're looking at the life of Jim Lovell.
Southern FM.
The sounds of the Bayside.
Where the space show is looking at the life of Jim Lovell. Now, disaster is never far away in human spaceflight, as was proven in the flight of Gemini 8, commanded by Neil Armstrong. Yes, that same Neil Armstrong. Let's take a listen.
Gemini 8, CSQ Capcom, contact Addy Reed.
We got serious problems here with this forward tumbling end over end, but we're disengaged from the engine.
Okay, we got your spacecraft 3 indication here.
Say again.
We're showing you spacecraft 3. What seems to be the problem?
Sir, roll enough and we can't turn anything off.
CSQ flight.
I have flight.
Did he say he could not turn the Agena off?
No, he says he is separated from the Agena and he's in a roll and he can't stop it. His rake pressure is down to zero, his arms rake helium pressure.
Well, they managed to save that mission and both of those astronauts went on to walk on the moon. Well, Jim Lovell was supporting that Gemini 8 mission, and he had this description back in 1999.
You then were Capcom on 8?
Yes.
Right? And there was a problem. Talk about that problem.
Well, Gemini 8 had a problem, probably one of the first big problems, and unbeknownst to us, when we were out of radio contact, a stuck thruster had occurred. Originally, Neil and Dave Scott were on that flight, thought that it might be the Agena, and they were trying to somehow, you know, slow the thing down. It was starting to make them roll, and so they thought, well, we better get rid of the Agena. They had already completed a rendezvous and docking, and so they jettisoned the Agena, and the spin-up increased, and it turned out finally that it was one of their thrusters that was firing, and so they managed, and they were very cool about this whole thing. They managed to pull the circuit breaker and get the thruster off the line, and then using the reentry thrusters, which were normally only used for reentry, they were able to slow the vehicle down, and of course they had to come back early.
What happened in mission control? What's going on around you while all this is going on up there, and nobody's sure what's going on?
Well, everybody's trying to think up solutions of what the problems are. The problem hit us all of a sudden because when they came back into radio contact, well, they said, hey, I guess to use the old phrase long before 13, we got a problem. But I think they managed to jettison the Agena and then determine their problem. And so it was sort of an aftermath back at the control center because I don't think there was much that we could have done in the control center for a problem like that. If they kept spinning up faster and faster, then it would be blacked out.
But this was, you realize after the fact, because you didn't know what was happening then, once they got around, you realized they had a very serious problem.
Oh, yes. If they didn't correct the problem themselves, they would have been in deep trouble.
Did that make you rethink anything about how safe or how unsafe this sort of thing is?
No, Ron, it's surprising. In this business, that problem was over there. You know, nothing's going to happen to me. Everything's fine. Don't worry about it. Space flight is so interesting. The rewards far overshadow the risks. And so that was my feeling.
That kind of test pilot mentality permeated everybody at NASA, did it?
I think so. I think the people who want to become astronauts, at least in those days, most of us were test pilots in those days, had that sort of a curiosity and adventure spirit to them that we were able to take that in stride.
You were next assigned to back up the Gemini 10 crew, but Bassett and C were killed.
Yeah.
And things changed. What happened after their death?
Well, a sort of fate. We were backing up 10, but the 9 backups became the prime backups. That was Stafford and Gene Cernan, I believe. So we became the backups to 9, and then what we did was to become the prime crew for the last Gemini flight. That was Gemini 12.
Did you realize that was the last one? Was it the last one scheduled, or
no? That was the last one.
That was the last one scheduled.
That was, and I wasn't going to go on Gemini if I was 10. You know,
yep.
Then.
Yeah. So it gave you an opportunity to fly Gemini again.
Yeah, and it gave me a little bit of a command opportunity, which I wanted.
And you were involved with the spacewalking mission on that. Talk about that.
That's very interesting because after Ed White's Gemini 4, which really didn't do much to learn about walking in space, they decided to do some pretty detailed work in outside the spacecraft. Started with really Gemini 9. They're going to have an AMU, an astronaut maneuvering unit, and it was in the back of the spacecraft. Gene Cernan was going to do the work on it. They got outside and tried to do the work, and the handholds were not good. The tow holes, he heated up. His visor fogged over. He had trouble doing things which he could do easily in training. And so eventually he came back into the spacecraft and they abandoned that. They again attempted on 10, not the AMU, but they attempted to do work on 10. What happened was that on 9 and 10, and then eventually also 11 when Dick Gordon was outside and he overheated and everything, all of us forgot about one of Newton's third laws of motion. To every action, there's an equal and reaction. Consequently, when they went to touch the spacecraft repelled them. You don't see that on Earth, but you sure see that up in space in the zero-gravity atmosphere when you have a big mass like the spacecraft. And so when 12 rolled around, they said, let's devote a lot of time on 12 to find out how we can really work outside the spacecraft. And it just so happened that someone, I don't know who it was, said, well, how about underwater? Wouldn't that give you sort of an idea of zero gravity if we can make the astronaut neutrally buoyant? And a spacesuit will work just as well underwater as it will in space. So NASA rented a swimming pool in a boys' school up in Baltimore. Buzz and I went up there with all the crew, and we put Buzz in a spacesuit, got him in the water, made him neutrally buoyant. I had communication with him, and I sat on the side of the pool as if I was inside the spacecraft. And we went through some of the basics. We had a crude mock-up in the water itself, learning about working in space, learning about the proper handholds and the proper tow holes to make sure that everything would work. And, of course, on 12, Buzz completed 3 spacewalks, about 5.5 hours, I guess, and, you know, everything was fine.
Everything
we were supposed to do, and no problem at all. So it was a major turning point in the ability to work outside a spacecraft.
But it also points out this sort of thing of somebody saying, hey, why don't we try a swimming pool? Were there those people all along the way saying, hey, why don't we try this? Why don't we do that?
Yes, as a matter of fact, in NASA, there's a lot of people who use their imagination. And, of course, it came to really if the forefront in 13. But, I mean, new ideas. That was the whole idea of NASA, new ideas. What can we do differently? How can we do this? And there were a lot of mistakes. There were a lot of blind alleys we went up to. Perseverance, though, was predominant in the program at the time. Let's keep on trying.
After landing Gemini 12, Jim Lovell described the use of the Rendezvous radar.
Gemini 12, the last of the Gemini series. Astronaut James Lovell describes, at a press conference, his problems with radar. The date, November 23rd, 1966.
We are getting set for our final maneuver down at the terminal phase initiation for the final rendezvous. When Buzz noticed that the computer wasn't given any change of range, And I had looked down at a little green light that tells us that we have a radar lock on, and it was off. And for a minute there, both of us just looked at each other. We said, oh, no, it can't happen to us. Anybody else or any other time, but gee, not this time. But something had dawned on us that, sure enough, our radar had indeed failed. And we went to the radar backup procedures, which we had practiced quite a bit in our pre-flight training, but really never expected to use. The first thing on my list, it said, acquire the target visually. And I looked up there, and I couldn't see a thing. Buzz took out his trusty sextant, which had an 8-power scope, and put it up to the window and spotted the target. And I looked up again, and that speck on the windshield turned out to be the Agena. So we bore sighted on the target, and the rest of the rendezvous is more or less history. It was successful. And now I'm sort of glad that we had a radar failure, because it gave us an opportunity to use the backup charts that all the crews have been practicing quite a bit, but have not really utilized.
And Buzz Aldrin's nickname was Dr. Rendezvous, because he had actually studied rendezvous techniques when he was at university. The diameter of the moon's shadow is not only small, it is also moving. How amazing it was that Lovell and Aldrin, traveling at 28,000 kilometers per hour, were able to fly Gemini 12 right through the umbra of a total solar eclipse.
In the following, Gemini 12 astronaut James Lovell describes the solar eclipse witnessed during the flight of November 1966.
I had on my side a very almost opaque gold filter, which I could see the round circle of the sun. And it was my job to track the sun through this filter as we came up to the eclipse. Just as the time was approaching, I could see the moon, which was a dark disk, come across the limb of the sun and start to occult it. I thought at first that we were really going to miss it, because it appeared that the moon was a little bit lower than the sun and that we would never get a total eclipse. But as we approached this position and we approached the time of totality, suddenly the complete window became black, and in an impulse I ripped off the filter and looked out, and I could see a black disk against a sort of a black sky with a brilliant ring around it of the corona of the sun. Just for a few seconds, I took a look at the total eclipse, and I knew that we had indeed completed the rendezvous. Shortly thereafter, I put the filter back on, and soon this very brilliant sphere of the sun shining through from the other side of the moon had taken place. It was quite a beautiful sight.
With the successful completion of the two-man Gemini missions, it was full steam ahead for the three-man Apollo lunar spacecraft. After some unmanned test flights, Apollo 1 was being prepared for the first manned mission, planned for 1967 February. Jim Lovell recounts the aftermath of the fire on the launch pad that killed three astronauts in 1967, January.
Then comes the Apollo program, and of course the Apollo fire. Do you recall where you were when you heard about the fire?
Oh yes, yes, very much so. I was in Washington, D.C. at the White House. I was up there for the signing of the Space Treaty, which essentially, you know, meant that space is available to everybody, there are no boundaries, and also that astronauts, if they have to land someplace else, will be welcomed rather than be treated as prisoners or something like that. And we had just finished that thing at the White House, and the four of us were going back to the hotel when we walked in, and there was messages for us to call NASA back again, and then they told us what had occurred, and we spent the night there. They said, don't go outside, don't mingle around, you know, just lose yourself. So we did, and the next day we went home.
You were assigned to a panel to study what went wrong. What was your study job?
Yes, there were some 20 panels, plus the major panel, and then there's 20 sub-panels. And I was with Jack Swikert, and I think it was Ron Evans, that we looked at how we can cope with in-flight emergencies, fires, to see what we'd have to have on board or what we can do for it. Very interesting investigation. I was, in my past career, I was a safety officer in a squadron and went through aviation safety school. So some of the stuff I had learned back then, I applied at that time.
I suppose the question that I need to ask, in light of the fact that this is a very conservative, safety-minded bunch of people up to this point, how in the world did Apollo 1 happen?
Well, I think, you know, when you look back on it, the fire in Apollo 1, we should have had plenty of warning ahead of time. We flew Mercury, we flew Gemini. All those spacecraft were tested on the ground by pumping in pure oxygen, and so that they could breathe, you know, after the pre-breathing, because we flew at low pressures. Well, on the ground, because spacecraft leak, you always pressurize it about a pound per square inch higher than the ambient pressure. So on the ground, they were at 16 pounds per square inch. We're in the outside about 15. Pure oxygen. Now, for all the Gemini flights, the Mercury flights, no problems. But Apollo, probably maybe due to the rush they were trying to do, the Block 1 was a disaster anyway, and they pumped it up. We should have realized that you didn't have to put pure oxygen in that spacecraft. You should have put a mixture in anyway of oxygen and nitrogen, because anything will burn in pure oxygen, as found out in the Apollo 1 fire.
Was there also any of the case to be made for the fact that the contractors quit listening to the astronauts and said, we don't need your input anymore?
In some respects, what I remember in that particular aspect, one of the reviews we had out at North America at that time was the hatch. They're telling us how this hatch was built. It was in two sections. There was an outer section and an inner section. And the inner section was there because of the spacecraft pressure would always keep the thing sealed against the side. But if you ever had to get out of the thing on the ground, it was disaster. And even in space, if you had to do an emergency return from the lunar module to go into the hatch side, you had to take off two hatches to do it. I mean, and so we mentioned that. We said, you ought to have a single-piece hatch here of some sort, something we could normally use and close. We had it in Gemini. I mean, you know, it is not impossible to build one of those things. We had one built and tested in Gemini. Why don't you do it here in Apollo? But no one listened until, of course, the fire started. And, of course, there was a time constraint, I would suspect, too, and they were looking at, gee, they want to modify the spacecraft again.
Plucked from the finest of flight schools regaled, from Mitchell, Grand Rapids, and Texas they hailed, Grissom and Chaffee and Ed White unveiled as the ones to fly the Apollo 1 test away. Apollo 1, NASA's away with Apollo 1. Fare thee well, don't stop till it's done. They're testing the crew of Apollo 1. Sputnik surprised us when it flew overhead. Yuri then beat us, it filled us with dread. But Shepard and Glenn and Mercury led to the test, to the crew of Apollo 1. Test away, Apollo 1. NASA's away with Apollo 1. Fare thee well, don't stop till it's done. They're testing the crew of Apollo 1. Gemini marched on from Mercury, strategically building technology. All were completed successfully. They're testing the crew of Apollo 1. Test away, Apollo 1. NASA's away with Apollo 1. Fare thee well, don't stop till it's done. They're testing the crew of Apollo 1. The new Saturn V will be finished up soon. We'll use propaganda and Disney cartoons and beat the damn commies with men on the moon. They're testing the crew of Apollo 1. Test away, Apollo 1.